Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this session of the General Insurance Seminar 2012. We have a small but clearly elite group here, so congratulations on that. We have an excellent paper in front of us. The paper is entitled A Topic of Interest, How to Extrapolate the Yield Curve. I personally think it's an important paper because a number of times I've had the issue of, you know, what do you do about your zero coupon yield curve for the durations beyond the end of the Australian government securities when those securities are available. And I've got two sources of zero coupon yield curves available to me, and I find that up to about 10 years to 12 years, the discrepancy between those two sources is very tiny, like less than 5 basis points. But once you get out further than that, it can be 50 basis points or more. So I think this is an important issue, particularly if you've got a significant portfolio of legacy liabilities that need to be valued. The paper is well written, well researched, and well referenced, and already available on the website. Our two authors today are Peter Mulquaney and Hugh Miller. We're going to hear in a moment, firstly from Peter, and then from Hugh. I'll sound a bell to give them a little bit of warning a couple of minutes before they're due to wind up. You remember that Vicky Mullen was talking this morning about the social contract, and we have a social contract here in this session. Our side of it is that we will guarantee to leave 10 minutes for questions, and your side is that you guarantee to think of some interesting, challenging questions or some witty and incisive remarks. Our two authors are Peter Mulquaney. Peter's a fellow of the Institute of Actuaries of Australia and employed by Taylor Fry Consulting Actuaries. He's been working as a consultant to the general insurance industry and government for over 9 years. He has a wide range of general insurance experience, from workers' comp valuations to domestic lines pricing and price optimisation. Peter also has a PhD in biochemistry from the University of Sydney and has previously worked as a research fellow at the University of Oxford. At Oxford, he develops suitable computer models of the normal and diseased heart in order to identify suitable patients for drug therapy. Hugh Miller. Hugh has been a member of the Taylor Fry team since 2006. In that time, he's been involved with a range of general insurance work, particularly valuations and pricing. He's also a core part of the company's analytics division and has undertaken data-intensive data analysis work for the government, insurance and telecommunications sectors. An active researcher, Hugh has published a number of papers on both statistical and actuarial topics. His recent paper on inflation assumptions presented at the last GI seminar was awarded the 2011 A.M. Parker Prize for Best Paper published by the Institute. He loves his two young children and used to love a good night's sleep. Ladies and gentlemen, please, without further ado, welcome, first of all, Peter Mulquaney.
Okay, thank you, John. As John mentioned, I'll be starting this presentation today, and my colleague Hugh will be finishing it off. And I'd also like to, if you came expecting to see a paper called Keeping It Real, this is the same paper. We've just changed the name as we finalised the paper. We realised that what we'd written didn't quite match the first title, so we've modified it a little bit, but we hope it's still of interest to you. Okay, for claims reserving, the concept of using a risk-free discount rate for discounting purposes is, I think, widely accepted in the Australian community. And what this means in practice is using a replicating portfolio. So a portfolio of, in general, certainly for APRA valuations, of Commonwealth government bonds, and using a basket of those bonds which provides a matching cash flow. And that's the basis for most reserving work discounting. But a question is, what do you do when the liabilities you are valuing have cash flows which extend beyond the longest dated Commonwealth government bonds? So at the moment, the longest dated bond is about 15 years in duration. So what do you do for those longer dated cash flows? And that's the topic of today's presentation. Okay, so the starting point for valuing long-term liabilities or discounting long-term liabilities is a need to extrapolate the yield curve. And this diagram, I guess, illustrates what are the three main technical issues around yield curve extrapolation. So the first one is deciding on what the last reliable point on the fitted yield curve you should use to start your extrapolation from. So in this diagram, the blue line represents my fitted forward rate yield curve. And if you notice, I've actually started the extrapolation a little bit before the end of the term. So we had bonds out to 15 years, and I've started my extrapolation from 13 years. So it's quite common to just start the extrapolation from the end, but later on we'll talk about reasons why this might not always be the right thing to do. The second main issue is, okay, having decided where to start the extrapolation, where should I extrapolate to? So what should my ultimate rate, or I've used the term unconditional forward rate, what should that be? And that's shown by the black dashed line here. So this is where I'm hoping to end up with it at the end of my extrapolation. And the third issue is, how should I get there? How long should it take me to get there? Should I get there within 5 years, or should I get there within 100 years? And also, more difficult to that is, what path should I take to get there? So those are the three main issues that we'll structure our talk around today. But before I talk about the technical aspects, I'd just like to give a brief consideration to the philosophical and regulatory considerations about yield curve extrapolation, because the answers, or what we I guess our philosophical approach, and also what the regulations dictate, will kind of help us determine how we answer those technical questions. So in very broad terms, there are two philosophical approaches to yield curve extrapolation. The first approach has an emphasis on market consistency at a point in time. So the idea here is to try and, so if you're building your yield curve of Commonwealth government bonds, trying to work out what the prices of Commonwealth government bonds would be at longer term. So if there was a 30-year Commonwealth government bond, or if there was a 50-year Commonwealth government bond, what would its price be on the day that you need to determine the yield curve? So that's the market consistent approach. The second approach has a greater emphasis on liability stability over time. So proponents of this view often say that the balance sheet volatility that's caused by a market consistent extrapolations is not helpful to actually running an insurance business, and therefore they'd actually emphasise liability stability. Now, there's differing degrees of views about what this entails, but some proponents will say, where you actually have matching assets, yes, it's fine to use a market consistent approach, but when you extrapolate, you should make considerations about liability stability. Now, I'm not going to talk about what the pros and cons of each of these philosophical approaches. Instead, I'm going to go to the Australian regulations and also to the Institute's professional standards to see if we can understand what they tell us we should do when we extrapolate the yield curve. Okay, so starting with AASB 1023, unfortunately it's silent on the issue, so it doesn't help us with our task. But moving on to APRA's GPS 310 and also the Institute's PS 300, you find, if you read them both, that they both have very similar requirements. And because they're similar, I've just listed one here. I've listed the requirements here from PS 300. And again, I won't read it, but I'll just highlight the main point. So, oops, sorry. The first thing to notice is, the first clause is that discount rates used must be based on the redemption yields of a replicating portfolio. Okay, so that's our uncontentious idea of using the replicating portfolio. And then the second clause deals with when you have to extrapolate. And it says, if the projected payment profile of the future claim payments cannot be replicated, for example, for classes of business with extended runoff periods, then discounts consistent with the intention of the earlier paragraph must be used. So I don't know about you, when I first read that, I was a little confused, because I said, if you don't have a replicating portfolio, go to the paragraph which tells you what to do with the replicating portfolio in order to extrapolate. So I may be the only person who read it that way. But when I had a closer look, it kind of, when, and emphasising this word consistent, it wants you to extrapolate consistent as though there is a replicating portfolio. At least that's my reading of it. So if I take that reading, it seems to be implying that we want a market consistent valuation. Most of you would be aware that APRA is about to release some new prudential standards, and this is a draft prudential standard 320, GPS 320 on discount rates. And again, I won't read through it, but it's just to say that their intention going forward seems to be to have a philosophy around a market-consistent approach. So in summary, it seems to us that the intention of both APRA's standards and also the Institute's PS 300 is for yield curve extrapolation to be performed on a market-consistent basis. And certainly that's the approach to the problem that we'll take throughout this presentation and the approach that was taken in the paper. Okay, so now on to the first technical question. So what is the longest market forward interest rate that we can estimate reliably? And to try and answer this question, what we did was determine the estimation error in the yield curve. So this is the estimation error around the forward rates that we estimate from Commonwealth government bonds. And I won't go into the technical details. We use a bootstrap method to get the estimation error. And I've just shown two examples of our estimation error in the forward curves for two different time periods. The one on the left is the calendar year end 2011, and the one on the right is year-end 2011-12 financial year. And on both of the graphs, the solid centre line represents our kind of underlying forward rate yield curve, and then the upper and lower lines, the dashed lines, represent a 90% confidence interval. So it tells us how reliably we can estimate the forward rates. And I guess the interesting thing to know that up until around years 11 or 12, the confidence interval is very tight. It's about 10 to 15 basis points, so we can estimate those forward rates relatively accurately. But by about year 13, it's spread out to 25 basis points, and by term 15, it's spread out to about 40 basis points. So it's suggesting that we shouldn't place too much faith in our last forward rates. There's quite a bit of estimation error involved. So in summary, we should not be overly reliant on the forward rate estimates made at the long end of the fitted curve, and at present it appears terms of about 13 years are appropriate. Okay, now onto the second technical question, and is what is the ultimate very long-term unconditional forward interest rate that we should extrapolate to? I'll take it as a given that this is a good thing to do. I don't have time to talk about why, but I think from the previous thing, the fact that there was uncertainty in the long-term forward rates is part of the reason. So simply, if we want to work out what the forward rate is at very long times into the future, there are two components that we need to estimate. One is the expected future short-term interest rate, which has got the components of expected future inflation and the real short-term interest rates. I'm not going to talk about them very much now because I don't have time to go into it. And the next one is the term premium. And the term premium is difficult to measure and has a lot of uncertainty about it, so that's what I'll focus on in the next couple of slides. Oops. Oh, what did I do? Sorry. Okay, so what term premia are is they're effectively the difference between the forward rate and the expected future short-term interest rates. They have a number of components, including risk premia, so that's kind of the reward for investing long. They have term preference, it's the idea that some institutional investors actually like to invest long because it gives a match to their portfolio. So here we've got risk premia driving forward rates up and term preferences driving them down. And lastly, convexity effects, which are a kind of a smaller technical effect, which I don't have time to go into now. But what in the idea of forecasting the ultimate forward rate, the difficult thing about term premia is that they have time-varying behaviour. And the question is, if this time-varying behaviour is, so from month to month or day to day, term premium are moving up and down a lot, should we actually transmit that variation to the very long term? So should we transmit it to the ultimate forward rate? And this diagram, I guess, attempts to illustrate that behaviour. So moving very quickly, what we have is the Reserve Bank in the US's breakdown of interest forward rates, which is shown by the blue line, into their two components. One component, the green line, being the expected short rate, and the other component being the term premium. And we've got this shown for 1 year forward rates, 5 year forward rates, and 10 year forward rates. And there's basically two things to take away from this diagram. One is that short rates, shown by the green line, by about 10 years are fairly stable. So the market's expectations of future short-term interest rates are pretty much flat and stable, and there's not too much volatility in it. But conversely, term premia are very volatile. So they're big at year 5 and they're still big at year 10. And the question is, what happens at very long terms? The answer is no one really knows. There's no empirical studies out of that distance. So what we have done in this paper is assume that they do converge, and the idea there is that because we don't really know the answer, let's choose an option which doesn't transmit unwarranted volatility into the balance sheet. I have to move on because I've run out of time, but this is our suggested ultimate forward rate, which talks about the components I've just listed, and you can go to the paper to find the details there. But we end up with an unconditional forward rate of about 5.8%, which actually is slightly a bit more optimistic than the experience we've had in Commonwealth government bonds since 98. So I'll just hand over to Hugh.
Thanks, Peter, and I'll add to his apology about the confusion with the name change of the paper, but I'll take back the apology slightly because I did enjoy being able to write two bad puns for the title instead of one bad pun. So that's a bonus. Okay, so the third question that Peter mentioned we'd cover is how quickly should we return to the UFR, so the unconditional forward rate? And we're going to primarily answer that question by looking at international evidence. So how quickly? So this is the schematic. It's a very similar plot to what Peter showed at the beginning of his section. Basically, we have an observed forward rate that we might know at 12 years, 13 years, something like that, and we need to sort of move that towards the unconditional forward rate. We do it linearly because we're not clever enough to do anything that's not linear. There are other options out there that are equally fine and have sort of smallish implications for the actual final points that you might choose. So this is topical for a couple of reasons. One is that the 10-year bond rate has moved a long way recently, so it used to always be close to 6. And if you've got a 10-year bond rate of 6 and an unconditional forward rate of about 6, the moving between the two is pretty trivial. So we have that, a low 10-year bond rate at the moment. And it's also topical because there are actually quite a few things that we've seen even in our own work with people making different rates of change moving to that unconditional forward rate. All right, so to look at the international evidence, we do this because in the UK, the USA and in Canada, there are a huge number. There are more bonds and they go for longer terms. So in all these cases, they go for 30 years, up to 30 years. And so they even go longer. So the UK does have some perpetual bonds. I looked at them and they are rubbish for pricing purposes, but there you go. So they can actually give us quite a lot of insight into how the yield curve behaves. And in particular, if you know the 10-year bond rate, what can that tell you about, say, the 25-year bond rate or the 30-year bond rate? We use the data since 1998. The reason for that is that's basically when the world discovered interest rate stability, inflation rate stability. And so inflation expectations have been fairly stable since that time. And if you go back further, you sort of have to disassemble which parts belong to inflation, which parts belong to real nominal or real interest rates, which is hard work. All right. So our first approach was a regression-based approach. So it's a very simple formula, one-dimensional linear regression. So in terms of notation, F stands for the forward rate. So the forward rate at time S plus T is a linear regression of a constant and a slope times the forward rate at time S. So S might be the 10-year bond rate, which we know, and we want to know what the 25-year forward rate is doing with respect to the 10-year forward rate. So the alphas basically reflect expected rate of return and term premia, so they're of less interest to us in this case. What's of more interest are the beta. So they basically tell you to what extent those two things depend on each other. So if you have a beta close to one, that basically means they're moving in parallel. So if the 10-year rate increases by 1%, the long-term rate will also increase by 1%. If your beta is zero, that's saying you have no relationship, so the movements in the 10-year rate might be effectively independent to those of the long-term rate. So you can then do this regression and choose different values of S&T and basically see how this pattern changes. And so as a little example, if we took the UK data and regressed the 20-year forward rate against the 10-year forward rate, we get a regression equation with a slope parameter of 0.74. So that's saying that there is quite a lot of relationship between the two, but it looks like there is some progress being made towards zero, so that they're not sort of completely moving in parallel. I hope that makes sense. So what you can do then, of course, is just what I'll present now is we fixed S at 10 years and we changed T, so we can basically see how that 0.74 changes when we change the length of time we look. So here's a graph for the UK results. And the results, I think, are quite striking for the UK. So basically the slope is very, very close to 1 for the first 5 years, basically saying you're basically getting parallel shifts, so for between 10 and 15 years. And at about 15 years, you get something that's very, very close to a linear decay, and that linear decay is relatively gentle. So at 25 years, you still get a slope parameter estimate of about 0.5. And you can see the point that we had on the previous slide. If you read up 20 on the x-axis and sort of move that across, that's the 0.74 that we had on the previous slide. So that's quite interesting. And because we get such a nice pattern, you can actually sort of squint and extrapolate that and say, yes, that looks like it will reach zero at perhaps time 34. And that actually sort of says that you don't, that's a reasonable approximation for when you might want to reach the unconditional forward rate. So I hope that makes sense. Here's the same graph except for US data. Interestingly, it's a little bit different. So you start at one, but instead of having those 5 years where you get parallel shifts, you get this linear decay occurring almost straight away. And that linear decay basically carries all the way through to the longest dated bonds that we had on our data set, which was the 30-year bonds. So that's nice, and you can show that I'm quite good at fitting a linear slope to a line that's practically linear. That's a good result too. And last we have Canada. So Canada was the basket case on this particular analysis. I put a straight line through it just for the hell of it. Or for completeness is what you say in technical papers. But you can see that in some ways it's a little bit of a guesswork there. So there's a summary table. And you can actually use bootstrap techniques to estimate confidence intervals around there. So what I've done here is basically listed where that decay starts at, and also the time at which we reach zero, so the slope parameter equals zero, so that's a reasonable proxy for our unconditional forward rate, and a 95% confidence interval for that. So there's a reasonable range, particularly between the UK and the US. You can see the confidence intervals are reasonably wide around that as well. There is a second type of analysis we did to basically answer the same question using the same data. But more is merrier, as they say. So this uses principal components analysis. If you're not familiar with the approach, the paper actually describes it in an appendix rather well. I wrote it, so I'm talking myself up there. It's short, so that's one definition of good. So basically, principal components analysis aims to capture the maximal variation in a system. So basically, what shape could I impose that explains most of the variation that we see in the yield curve from month to month. So if that's a parallel shift or whether it's something different. So that actually gives us considerable insight into how the yield curve moves over time. So here's a couple of sort of illustrative shapes just so you get a sense of what the principal component analysis is trying to do. So firstly, the blue line is what would happen or what the principal component would look like if the yield curve primarily moved by parallel shift. And so that basically means if at the 5-year duration you go up by 1%, because it's flat, you're basically saying it shifts by moving up 1% everywhere. If you do your principal components analysis and say, yes, that flat shape is what we observe as the shape that describes maximal variation, then that's strong evidence that the yield curve primarily moves in maximal shift. Conversely, you've got the orange line there, which is the schematic of what you'd see if you see quick mean reversion to the unconditional forward rate. So basically, you have this parallel shift behaviour at the left-hand side, so up to 15 years, say, but when you do have that movement, you actually have relatively little movement on the right-hand side, so that sort of stays fixed relative to the left-hand side of that chart. And so that's what you'd expect to see if you were seeing fast mean reversion. The other trick to principal component analysis is that it gives you a leading component, which explains most of the variation, and you can actually extract second and third and fourth components that explain other bits of the variance that the first component doesn't change. So here's the analysis for the Canadian curve. I started with Canada because it was our problem last time, and this time it actually looks quite good. So the blue line is the leading principal component. It explains over 80% of the variance, so this is the default way that the yield curve moves, and it's very close to flat. That's the first observation. So in general, parallel shift is the way. What you can see, if you squint really hard, though, on the right-hand side, you can see a little bit of decay starting. And that is statistically significant decay. Like if you do the analysis and bootstrap and whatever else, you do get that decay persisting. And you can actually use that decay to extrapolate a time to return to the unconditional forward rate. So that's actually another way that you can estimate that time to decay. The second and third components I included there for completeness, for the hell of it. But it tells you interesting things as well. So the reason why our regression was a bit weird is I think that second component there that has this huge bulge in the middle terms, so between 10 and 15 years, and that's one of the reasons why this gives a slightly different result to the regression result. Here's the PCA for the USA. Again, we have a very flat leading component and statistically significant decay towards the right-hand side of that chart. And here's the UK curve. It turns out to be the problem child in this particular type of analysis, and that's because the short-term rate in the UK has been doing quite unusual things relative to anywhere else, I think. But that notwithstanding, once you get to about 10 years, you're getting basically parallel shift and you're still getting a little bit of statistically significant decay. All right. So there's a summary of that. So we have extrapolated those decays and basically got a duration that where we reach the UFR in a similar way to how we did the regression. And you can see that the numbers are actually a little bit bigger. So we speculate in the paper why that might be, but suffice to say that two different analyses give slightly different answers. So in conclusions to this, basically we think somewhere in the range of 40 to 100 years is pretty plausible in terms of time to reversion, and duration 60 is a reasonable central estimate. And this sort of weights the regression result a little bit more than the PCA. And I should point out that this is a fairly slow reversion. So for most GI, general insurance problems, what you see is that a slow reversion like that is pretty much equivalent to a flat interest rate curve in terms of actual sort of impact. And it's basically quite strong evidence against a fast reversion too. So I'm going to talk through hedging very, very quickly because we have a social contract. Thanks, John. So two questions you may have. One is this all academic given that these bonds don't exist? So is there any practical value to be able to extrapolate the curve? And second question you might have is this relevant for Australian data? UK is not Australia. And so this approach that we're using here tries to answer both those criticisms by looking at long-term hedging strategies. So suppose you have a liability in 20 years' time and you don't have any bonds that you can match with that because your bonds don't go out that far. It is actually possible to duration match by selling short-term bonds and buying your longest available term bonds. And that way you actually sort of increase your interest rate leverage. And that actually can allow you to duration match. So it's sort of a wonky version of immunisation that we all learnt in our exam process. But to do that effectively, you actually do need a yield curve extrapolation. So for that long-term liability, you need to know its present value, you need to know its duration, so that you can actually do that matching effectively. And so if you have a fast reversion assumption or a slow reversion assumption, that will actually impact how you construct that hedging portfolio. And so it's actually an empirical way where you can test the effectiveness of a fast reversion versus a slow reversion. So we've done this on Australian data. So it's a very simplified model. Suppose we have $100 that we need to pay back to someone in 20 years, and we have only 4 and 10 year zero coupon bonds available, and they sort of get renewed each quarter. So at the end of a quarter, we have to rebalance our portfolio by selling our 9 3/4 year bond and buying a new 10 year bond. And so what we'll do to duration match is we'll short sell the 4 year bond and go long in the 10 year bond. And we can then, over the next 10 years, track our hedging performance, so see how our portfolio value changes relative to our liability value. And at 10 years, you can sort of close your position by just buying a 10-year bond, so you don't need to monitor beyond that. So we test the two different approaches, a fast reversion to UFR, so fast in this case is linearly from 10 years to 20 years, versus a slow reversion, which in this case is actually sort of infinite time. Okay, and here's the hedging performance on Australian data over 10 years since June 95. And you can see two things, actually. One is that the hedging is surprisingly good. So this is where we're doing a long-short portfolio to hedge something which has a very long duration, and we're within a couple of cents at the end, which is a fluke. But over any point in time, you're only a couple of dollars off, which I think is actually a pretty remarkable result. The second thing is that the slow path, the blue line, is much, much better than the fast reversion to a UFR. So it's actually saying this slow assumption does actually give you better hedging performance. So we've done it over a number of time periods. The blue line's always better, I claim. You might quibble on June 2000, but I'll quibble back. You can ask at the end. So our conclusions there is that the slow reversion does give better hedging performance, and that's further evident on Australian market data. And this sort of hedging approach is actually much, much better than just buying a 10-year bond. So two more slides, 4 conclusions and 2 comments. So the conclusions are, basically reiterating what we said, a yield curve can be estimated effectively up to about 2 years before the longest dated bond. Around 60 duration seems to be a reasonable choice for reversion to UFR. The linear path is plausible, but you could use something else if you're feeling adventurous. And you can actually hedge using this type of information, long-term liabilities. Saying there are other 2 comments is there's some confusion, we think, in the Australian standards that could be a little bit clearer, and that the slow reversion actually forces us to make some philosophical questions there between market consistency, which is what we've been focusing on, and liability stability. Apologies, John.
Ladies and gentlemen, I don't think we've left quite the full 10 minutes, but we're still going to hold you to your half of the social contract. Now, there's a microphone there in the middle of the floor, and because the session is being recorded, we ask that you state your name and company before you ask your question. So I'll leave it to you to address questions to Peter and Hugh.
Hi, I'm Harry Haggard from PricewaterhouseCoopers. I was just wondering... You've looked quite a lot at the data to develop all of this. I was wondering if you thought about perhaps just a different perspective of how you might look at this in terms of kind of the interest rate just being a supply and demand thing. And you've kind of touched on that, but maybe projecting out or thinking about how supply and demand might change in future.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it is a supply and demand issue, and that's what I think contributes to the day-to-day and month-to-month volatility in the yield curve that you get. Because it is, in the end, it's people buying and selling bonds, so supply and demand drive everything. I guess we take the point that being the case, our job is, in a market-consistent yield curve extrapolation, to work out how we should extrapolate on that day, so know what the prices are on that day. And it raises all sorts of questions about what do you do out at terms of 50 years? What do you do with term premium out at 50 years in Australia? Because the bonds don't exist. You know, we don't know what institutional investors would be doing to term premium, whether they're bidding them down or up. All very difficult questions. But it's about doing the best you can to approach what the market is on that day, and it'll never be perfect, but I mean, we've suggested one approach which we think is consistent with being market consistent. So
I'll add a comment just because I can't help myself. I guess supply and demand in some ways are taken care of by the market. So you can't just say, well, there's a lot of supply coming in from international buyers, so we should increase the yield assumptions just because the market is what the market is. So if there is a lot of demand and you have to hedge your position for a certain set of liabilities, you have to sort of accept that market price. So in some ways, you can... I shouldn't say this, but you can almost ignore supply and demand by actually just looking at what the market is doing and the yield curve you extrapolate there.
Hi, Bruce Watson from Comcare, thank you. I was talking to someone about this recently and said that pre and post GFC was a seismic shift in terms of term premium, that you, whatever had been there before was totally different post GFC, and you had to sort of a time dependency of that which didn't seem to highlight that quite so clearly in your analysis.
Yeah,
Can you talk about that a bit?
It does have some interest. If I can go back, that figure has a lot of interesting things that we didn't touch on. Okay, I guess if you focus on the right hand side, so the 10-year forward rate, and look at the term premium curve, which is the red curve. You can see that the GFC would have happened around here, and according to that, there's not much has happened. But in the last, I think it's about year, term premium really have dived, and they're kind of only slightly above 0%. And if you go back to the 5-year, over the last year, term premium have been negative in the 5-year. So I think a lot of the discussions have been around this more recent. And that's the kind of talk around that is a flight to quality, that people are willing to, you know, pay more for bonds than the return that, you know, than the interest rate return they're going to get, because they want high rated quality bonds, which Australia has. So I think it does show some of the things that people have been talking about.
Richard Brooks, Taylor Fry. Just to add to that, I guess the point behind the analysis you've done, though, is that given the reversion to the unconditional rate is so long, it kind of doesn't matter what the term premium or the term premium that you assume for that unconditional rate, because for most liabilities, until you're getting out to 30 or 40 years, you can consider the yield curve as just moving up and down.
Yeah, I think that's correct. When you estimate your fitted forward curve out until 10, 15 years, you take the term premium on the day that exists, and then you're stuck with it. That's the one. I mean, you'll slowly go up to some ultimate level, but it seems to happen pretty slowly.
Early. Take that, everybody else.
Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I don't know about you, but I find some actuarial presentations are technical, some are entertaining, and some have really important consequences for our practical valuation work. But I think today we might have seen that miracle of the intersection set, because I thought they were all of those three things. Can you please join with me in congratulating Peter and Hugh?